This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, what labor wants and what it might get. In the final weeks of the election campaign, there were voters in battleground states who opened their front doors and found the president of the AFL-CIO standing on their porch. John Sweeney and plenty of his fellow union members had a heartfelt pitch that they delivered in door knockings, phone calls, and in one-on-one conversations during the election campaign, where they talked about the necessity of a counterbalance to corporate power in this country and the need for new legislation known as the card check bill. The stakes for labor are high, union membership is in decline, and their negotiating clout with corporate leadership has waned. But they helped turn out the voters who made Barack Obama victorious last week, spending millions of dollars through their political action committees. So with a newly elected Democratic president and larger Democratic majorities in Congress, is labor in the catbird seat after such a long dry spell under Republican rule? And why is one of our guests today saying business should prepare for Armageddon? We'll find out in a moment from our guests. Here are some questions for you, our audience, to think about, and I hope you'll join our conversation this morning. If you're a member of a union, tell us what you consider to be the top priority from this new administration. And if you own or manage a business, what does it mean day to day for you? That unions may have more clout and that new legislation may pass Congress. So if you're a member of a union, tell us what you consider to be the top priority from the new administration. And if you own or manage a business, what does it mean day to day? The unions may have more clout and we may see new and different legislation. To our guest this hour, Bill Samuel is legislative director for the AFL-CIO, and he's with us this morning from Washington. Bill, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks.
Randy Johnson is with us. He's vice president of Labor, Immigration, and Employee Benefits at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he is also with us from Washington. Randy, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning.
Let me put our phone number out for our listeners here who I hope are thinking about those questions. Again, if you're a member of a union, tell us about your top priority from the new administration and a larger Democratic majority in Congress. If you own or manage a business, your concerns about the idea that union may have more clout, 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can reach us online at minnesotapublicradio.org and click on Send a Question. Bill Samuel, before we look ahead, I just want to look back for a minute and frame this conversation. It is true that union membership is at historic lows. Only 12% of the country's workforce belongs to a union. Does that tell us that our economy is changing and that many workers do not really feel like they need to be part of a union anymore to get what they want from their employers?
Well, our economy is certainly changing, but I'm not sure I would agree that workers have decided they don't want to be represented and have a voice on the job. In fact, we've seen some recent polls which suggest that over 50% of workers who don't belong to unions wish they had one at work and would join one if that opportunity presented itself.
So why do so few actually belong then?
Well, I think it's become very difficult for workers to form unions in today's environment. We have a labor law that was written in the 1930s, and we have a business class which has changed dramatically in the last 80 years. It's globalized. It's much more powerful than it's ever been. The public sees that. I think by 70% or more people think corporations are too powerful. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but we have to keep up with the changing economy if workers are going to have a voice on the job.
Randy Johnson, how do you interpret the low ebb of union membership?
Well, in a lot of ways, the unions have done too good of a job. Back in the 30s and 40s, of course, or earlier, no one, I think, questioned the need for unions. There was very few laws on the books that protected workers. But nowadays, and due to a lot of the good effort by the unions on Capitol Hill, we've got the Family Medical Leave Act. We've got OSHA protections, EEO protections. There's a full panoply of federal laws that now protect workers on the job. And in one way play the role that unions used to play in the 40s. And I think there's just, I'll have to say, there is still stories of union corruption that come out in the press from time to time. It's not as bad as it was in the 50s, but it's still in the background. I think the unions have just sort of, they've typically, when I do a Labor Day speech, the rhetoric coming out of the labor movement is unions are bad. I mean, employers are bad. You need unions to protect yourself from employers. You know, and most employers, they're just not the employers of the 40s and the 30s anymore. Most of them try and do a pretty damn good job by their employees. And I think overall, employees really see less of a need for unions to protect them from their so-called bosses.
Bill Samuel, do you think that Randy Johnson has something there in the way that the unions have in the past framed this us against them issue, and that the unions have to accept that attitudes about employers may have changed in some parts of the job market, I should say?
I'm sure attitudes have changed, but I think the situation is not that different. Workers still want to get ahead. As I said, they still want to have a voice on the job. And if you just look at the economy today, you'll see the wages have flatlined. Now, that's an expression that President-elect Obama uses. And one of the reasons is workers have lost the power to bargain for higher wages to get a piece of the productivity and the profits that they're helping to generate.
Give me some specific examples, can you?
Examples of what?
Of situations of companies, of corporations where that has occurred, where members are losing their ability to bargain.
Well, there aren't specific companies. It's economy-wide. You said yourself about 7.5% of the private sector is represented by unions now. And if you look at the trajectory of wages since the 1970s, when the labor movement began to decline in numbers and relative and strength, you saw wages begin to stagnate. Wages were not keeping up with productivity as they had throughout most of the last century. We used to grow together in this country. When companies made money, so did workers. CEOs made about 50 times what the shop floor, what the worker on the shop floor made. Now, we all know the CEO and the executives in the corporate suites are making 300, 400, 500 times what ordinary workers are making.
And that's a
reflection of the lack of worker bargaining power.
Tell me what unions can do about that, though. You're right. That gap just continues to grow between the person in the corner office is making, what the person maybe on the plant floor or in the cubicle in the company. What can a union really do about that?
Well, it's what unions are set up to do, bargain collectively. If workers are able to join together and form unions, the employer by law has to sit down and negotiate a contract, the terms and conditions of employment. That includes wages and benefits. Remember, you know, in the 1940s and right through the 1990s, workers could expect to get health insurance and a decent pension at work in addition to a decent wage that would rise over time. That's less and less the case now, and it's because fewer and fewer workers have the opportunity to bargain a collective bargaining agreement with their employer.
Randy Johnson, isn't that a good issue for unions? Because we know that Americans do not like this growing gap between the people at the top and the people in the middle at the bottom of these companies. That's fertile ground, isn't it, for unions?
Well, it would be hard for me to argue that when the press reports on some of these huge CEO salaries and that it's not fanning the flames of some resentment over the current system. But, you know, a few CEO salaries can't drive, I think, policy that's going to apply to the entire American workforce. I agree that is something the unions have fixated on, and I don't blame them for that. Let me say, though, that the union decline has continued. It really started from their height in the 50s and has steadily gone downward through the 60s and 70s and 80s. And here we are in 2010, and there's not, I mean, to pretend, it's a pretense to say there's a direct link between the decline of union membership and decline in wages. I mean, the high-tech industry obviously paid very well. Very little unionization there. Now, they went in their own decline several years ago. So it's up and down. It's cyclical. But, you know, if workers in a workplace feel they're not being treated right or they feel that they can bargain for better wages for a union, then they ought to vote for a union. Our primary problem with the current legislation on Capitol Hill, which Bill supports, is it takes away the right to a secret ballot election.
This is the check card legislation.
Yeah, which is
card check.
Card check, sorry. Let's explain exactly what it is.
Should I go first?
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Since 1935, workers have been able to organize themselves through something called voluntary recognition. They would distribute a petition or authorization cards at the workplace, and once they got over 50% of the workers to sign this card, They could present it to the employer, and the employer could voluntarily accept that showing of majority support and begin bargaining, recognize the union, and bargain a contract. That's been the law since the beginning. Unfortunately, in the last 20, 30 years, employers have used essentially loopholes, changes in the at the National Labor Relations Board to deny that request, to deny that showing of support, sending the workers then to the National Labor Relations Board to ask for an election. It's always been legal to have a have card check, but more and more employers have decided they'd rather have the election, and there's a very simple reason for that. The election allows them to campaign against the union. There's a two or three or longer a month period for the employer, who has the workers, of course, on his or her property 8 hours a day, to campaign against the union before the election. So what the Employee Free Choice Act would say is if workers distribute cards, organizing committee wins the support of 50% plus one of the workers, that should be the decision that the employer has to accept and respect, and then begin bargaining a contract.
Randy Johnson, well, you have said that if if there is legislation to do away with secret ballot union elections, it will be Armageddon. That sounds pretty dramatic. Why?
Yeah, and I told the reporter I have perhaps only used that word twice in my 20 years doing this stuff.
So why?
Well, first of all, I don't think Bill quite has described the bill correctly. Sorry, Bill. One is he's left out the other part of the law since at least 1947. An employer, when they are given these so-called card checks, which the courts have said, not the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which the courts have said can be routinely be subject to union abuse and coercion because they are placed in front of an employee with union people around and asked whether or not you want to support a union.
Your concern is peer pressure.
It's peer pressure. But an employer has always had the right to say, okay, you've presented me with these cards, but I want a secret ballot election. So I want the National Labor Relations Board to come in, conduct a government-supervised private vote. I don't know how the employees are going to vote one way or the other, but at least it's going to be private, and they'll have the employees will have a free choice, free from coercion to make a decision.
So why does the elimination of something like this prompt you to say that it would be Armageddon for business?
Well, and the second part of the bill is as ominous to us, if not more. In this process, if the employer has to recognize the union through these card checks, and they bargain, now a lot of people don't know about this part about the bill, and they bargain for 90 days, and the union and the employer quote unquote fail to come to an agreement, mm-hmm. a binding an arbitrator can be appointed by the government to impose a contract on the employer, literally setting all terms and conditions of employment from OSHA to how much money would go into your 401k plan, health care, work rules, etc. So here's the image. Here's it's actually a panel of three arbitrators are going to decide for an employer how that employer is going to run his or her company. And that could range from a company of 5,000 people to a company of 10.
And you think that's disastrous.
So are we willing to turn over the running of our companies to a panel of government arbitrators? No, we're not. And that is even more unprecedented under the National Labor Relations Act.
Bill, a quick comment here, and then I'm going to go to the phones.
Okay, well, I'm not exactly sure where to start, but back to the card check, I guess,
yes.
First.
Yep.
Randy describes a situation that exists on paper, and it sounds pretty good, this free election, this secret ballot. Unfortunately, in practice, it's nothing like that, and any of your listeners who's ever gone through an organizing campaign knows that. As I said, the employer has access to the workers 8 hours a day, has control of their wages, their hours, their duties, and routinely now during these campaigns calls workers into what we call captive audience meetings, meaning they have to show up and they can't speak. There's no give and take. It's not like a real election campaign. They can be threatened in all kinds of ways, legal and illegal, and coerced into opposing the union.
But tell me at bottom here, for our listeners who are not deeply steeped in all of the details here, what is the union's problem with allowing secret ballot elections to decide whether you want to bring a union into the shop or not?
The secret ballot itself is not objectionable, but it conjures up in most people's minds a fair and open campaign, which mm-hmm. does not exist. We think if the workers on their own decide to form a union by passing around a petition or cards, that should be binding on the employer.
Okay.
The only reason the employer wants the election is because they want the opportunity to campaign. It's not about protecting workers' privacy.
Gentlemen, I really do want to bring some listeners in. We will not move away from this topic, though, through the hour. Bill Samuel, one of our guests here, legislative director for the AFL-CIO, Randy Johnson, Vice President of Labor, Immigration, Employee Benefits at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I'm asking you, as you listen to this conversation, if you are a member of a union, tell us what you consider to be the top priority from the new administration. Is it this, what we're talking about, the secret ballot and this legislation that is on Capitol Hill and is a top priority for the AFL-CIO? If you own or manage a business, what does it mean day to day that unions may emerge from this Obama administration and larger Democratic majorities in Congress with more clout? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. If you're online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question to Jennifer in Minnetonka. Hi, thanks for waiting.
Good morning.
Morning.
I guess for much of my life, I've sort of had this image of unions based upon, you know, I think you read The Jungle and you've got poor work environments and, you know, the need to raise up workers. So I think for much of my life, you know, I've had this very positive view of unions. However, I think that in the last few years, there's been some examples that have maybe given me not altogether positive view of unions and how they supposedly advocate for workers. And I think that if there was a little bit of a shift in viewing unions as a business themselves, and a business whose customer base is dropping, perhaps for good reasons, that might allow people to view things a little bit differently.
Jennifer, you're concerned about the tactics, is that right, that the unions have used in some cases?
That's right. And, you know, I have to say that I'm not completely familiar with the whole card check issue, but let me cite just a few examples for you. Through my husband's job, we've been transferred around the country a number of times over the last few years, and in doing so, certain segments of his business are unionized, other segments are not. So I've observed and seen, you know, votes take place and things like that. His company recently won a lawsuit because union workers were following individuals home and threatening things such as, you know, if you don't get on board with the union, we'll call the INS and have family members deported and so on and so forth. And like I say, they won the lawsuit, so clearly the evidence was there. And I think that so many times, even what you heard throughout this campaign is, you know, the evil businessman who, you know, hires illegal workers or hires workers and then doesn't fulfill his obligations as an employer. You know what? There's sometimes things on the other side as well, and I don't think that we always get that view.
Let me ask Bill Samuel about tactics. Bill, unions in some quarters have gotten a bad name because some of the tactics that some unions are using?
Well, no question there are bad apples, and it's illegal if they do that. And the penalties are very harsh. If unions coerce workers in any way leading up to an election, the election's thrown out. Basically, the union gets, the death penalty. And if an employer coerces workers or threatens workers, threatens to close the plant, threatens or actually fires workers, the penalties are very, very mild. So actually, I'm sure conditions exist occasionally or situations exist like the caller identify. We certainly don't accept that or expect it. And it's illegal. It shouldn't happen.
Randy Johnson, I know we said we'd come back to the card check issue here. Is coercion one of the concerns that businesses have about this?
Well, there's two parts. We have a concern, has been expressed by the courts and the National Labor Relations Board over coercion, the power that unions have in open settings to pressure workers to sign these mm-hmm. so-called card checks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not making this up. The courts have commented on it and noted that the secret ballot process is the much preferred process of determining whether or not a worker wants to be represented by a union because of the concerns of coercion. And we've had former union organizers testify on the Hill about how they approached employees at night, for example, at their homes, and coerced employees into signing these cards. But, you know, can there be the flip side to Bill's point? Can there be situations where employers improperly discipline or discharge someone for union organization activities? Yeah, and that is a violation of the law under 8A1. But, you know, this has been the law since 1947. And it was only until recently that the unions had complaints about it. They didn't really have complaints about it when the National Labor Relations Board was being run by the Clinton appointees. But the broader point, I'm sorry, Kerry, would be, you know, if there's a problem with regard to sort of discrimination during a union organizing campaign, okay, let's talk about that. But the answer isn't a sweeping, massive change such as proposed by the Employee Free Choice Act, which gets rid of the secret ballot election and imposes binding arbitration on employers. I mean, the fix that the unions are pursuing here sweeps much more broadly than the wrongs they're identifying as the reason for the legislation.
Randy, are you convinced that binding arbitration piece of this will remain?
Over my dead body.
Well, I mean, in the negotiations, it will go on. Bill Samuel, is that a key part of this legislation that you'll push hard for, or is there some negotiation?
From what I've
been reading, it sounds like leaders are saying that there might be some negotiation there.
Well, we will push for it. I think people have to understand again what the problem is that we're trying to address. In about a third of the cases where a union succeeds in representing the workers, the employer never agrees to a collective bargaining agreement. The pressure on an employer to agree to the terms of a collective bargaining agreement really don't exist in the law now. The worst thing they can get from the National Labor Relations Board is a finding that they bargained in bad faith and an order that they go back to the table. This can go on for years, and in many cases it does. Our point in proposing this binding arbitration is, first of all, we look to Canada where this has been in effect and has worked very well. Neither unions nor employers want to turn over bargaining to a third party, and it's very rarely utilized. The reason is because it pretty much instills in both the union negotiators and the company negotiators the incentive to get a deal themselves.
All right.
And that's most of the time what happens. And under this proposal, it would only happen once. Binding arbitration would only be available for the first contract, and that contract would only last 2 years. And it's only if the parties themselves can't reach an agreement.
Let me go to the phones here to Elliot in St. Paul. Elliot, you're director of the Ask Me Council number 5 here in St. Paul. Is that right?
That's correct.
What'd you want to say?
Well, I'd like to say to the corporate person on the phone, on the radio, that every 23 minutes an American worker is punished or fired for trying to form a union. And the act itself would end in fear, intimidation, and stalling tactics used by employers to prevent workers from bargaining together for better wages, benefits, and working conditions. You know, it took us 5 years of employer opposition to get a union after a vote of 2/3 to 1/3 in favor of the union at Walker Methodist Nursing Home. Workers are routinely fired, harassed, one-on-one meetings take place in the workplace, and all the workers want is to try to form a union.
Randy Johnson,
now,
what about
this,
that?
This doesn't take away the right to form a union. This doesn't take away the right to secret
Elliot,
ballot.
Elliot, we've been over all the details. I want to ask Randy Johnson for a response to what you said.
So if people are being harassed in the workplace, as you mentioned, there are remedies existing under current law for that. Now, one might argue that the current remedies under the National Labor Relations Act could be strengthened. Again, the solution to that problem you identify, I don't know how you could say the solution to that is to take away an employer's ability to call for a National Labor Relations Board supervised secret ballot election to ensure that there's no coercion on either side, employer or union, when that worker wants to go into that private voting booth or ballot box and put his or her decision in that box, yay or nay. I don't get the solution you guys are proposing to the problem.
Elliot, go ahead real quick.
Well, workers are already signing cards on their own, their free choice, to have a union. They ought to have a say in if there's an election or not. Right now, the only choice is the employers. The workers ought to have
that's
right.
No, that's not right. The workers
that is correct.
The workers
you know
present 31%
You know it, and the employer.
Could we hear Randy Johnson for a second?
Except he's wrong. He keeps saying the same thing over and over again. And in fact, employers use every single stalling tactic that gives them the advantage in the law. The law is a corporate law.
I think that's something Bill Samuel said, and we covered that. Go ahead, Randy.
If the union presents cards over 30% of the bargaining unit, they go to the employer, and the employer has the right to ask for a secret ballot election.
I think that
they don't have the right to say, "Oh, we're not going to have an election."
That's an important point, though, Kerry, that Elliot made that Randy kind of glosses over. It's right now the choice of the employer to have the election. Under the Employee Free Choice Act, the employees would have the right to decide whether or not they want an election. We don't eliminate that in the law; it still exists. Or seek recognition through cards. And the reason they do, and so often today, seek recognition through cards is because they don't want to subject themselves to this very coercive, antagonistic campaign that the employers run that Elliot just described at his company.
Let me take another call here before we go to news to Jonathan in Minneapolis. Hi, Jonathan. You're on Mid Morning.
Hi, good
Hi.
Morning.
Yes.
I just wanted to comment on a couple things. I'm a business owner, mm-hmm. and I have a number of friends that are small business owners, and it's very detrimental to our business.
How so?
Well, I mean, I'm not anti-union entirely because I think they have served purpose in certain industries. It seems like it's necessary, but I have friends who've had to go out of business because of unions and have... It's very hard on the small company. Probably after you get to a certain inertia, you have a certain size of company, it probably is doable. But
Jonathan, because of wage demands, benefit
right.
demands, why?
Right. So to give you an example of a friend of mine who owns an electrician company, and he only had 5 employees. And they were approached by some outside union organization and essentially coerced into starting a union because they were promised they'll get more wages and such. But as soon as they became a union, the employer, he was already having a hard time making payroll, so he had to go out of business because of the impact of having to pay nearly double the wages. And he was paying at the time market rate. So,
Jonathan, I appreciate the call. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
We're going to take a break for news. When we come back, continue our conversation. We're going to talk about some of the other priorities that labor has with the coming in of this new administration and larger Democratic majorities on Capitol Hill. We'll talk about interest in stepping up the minimum wage. Again, Congress passed an increase in the minimum wage, goes up to $7.25 an hour by next summer. We'll talk about interest in raising that, and we'll talk about this equal pay issue. If you'll recall, President-elect Obama talked about this on the campaign trail. Are unions going to push hard for that? Will there be legislation beyond just trying to remove time limits for suing on wage discrimination? We'll talk about all of that with our guest, Randy Johnson, Bill Samuel, when we come back. 800-242-2828 if you want to join us. 651-227-6000. If you're getting a busy signal on the lines because we have full lines here, you can always reach us online, minnesotapublicradio.org, and click on Send a Question, and I will get to some of the online comments and questions as well on the other side of news. To the newsroom and Perry Finelli. Good morning, Perry.
There are some same-sex couples in Connecticut plan to be married today now that a judge has cleared the way for the same-sex unions. Today's order follows up on a ruling from the state Supreme Court last month that same-sex couples have a right to be married. Stocks are down for a third straight day. The latest declines come amid new evidence that consumers are sharply cutting back on spending. Department store operator Macy's says it lost $44 million in the third quarter. Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm is backing calls from Democratic leaders in Congress for a bailout of the American automobile industry. She says the national economy rests on it. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Congress yesterday to approve a bailout. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson this morning is talking about the progress of the $700 billion financial bailout. The man who helped get the Iraq War started, retired U.S. Army General Tommy Frank, says with time, President-elect Obama will do the right thing when it comes to the war. He says as president, Obama will be getting a different look at day-to-day military operations. Authorities have fined dozens of Minnesota deer hunters who illegally used bait during last weekend's opener. According to the Star Tribune, they've also confiscated guns from several of them, as part of stepped-up efforts to snuff out deer baiting. It's a practice that's been illegal since 1991 but continues to be widespread. An Augsburg college student says she was assaulted on the Minneapolis campus and called a racist because she was wearing a McCain Palin button. Annie Grossman says she was attacked by 4 young women as she walked back to her dorm room after watching the returns on election night. No arrests have been made. Cloudy skies around the state today. High temperatures, mid to upper 30s. Twin Cities now clouds and fog. Temperature 33. It is 9:35. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor. You know, tickets for A Prairie Home Companion's fall run at the Fitzgerald are on sale now. And we're adding some Friday night shows. Same stuff as on Saturday with Tim and Tom and Sue and the shoe band and musical guests and the news from Lake Wobegon, Guy Noir, all the rest, but without the clock running. For more information on schedules and dates, you can visit us at prairiehome.org or at ticketmaster.com. See you this fall at the Fitz.
Programming is supported by the Shakopee Mittawakatin Sioux community, who have given 254 defibrillators to charitable organizations, schools, and others. To request an AED for your organization, you can go to shakopeedakota.org.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, photographer Stephen Keselowski is going to be in the studio with us. He went to some amazing places and did some astonishing things to get, well, I would say unprecedented pictures of polar bears. I mean, at one point he camped out for 17 days to watch a mother polar bear who'd been hibernating emerge from her den. When she went off, he crawled into the den and took photographs. And of course, while he was on this photographic journey, he was also noticing how climate change is changing the environment that the bears live in and the way the bears behave and their future. So Stephen Keselowski in the studio with us, we're talking about his new book, The Last Polar Bear. And of course, we'll be talking about how climate change is affecting the bears. That's at 10. Also, one of the books that is featured on the Mid-Morning book page, check it out by going to the main Mid-Morning page. Look on the right-hand side. You'll see a link that says What Carrie's Reading. Click it, and it will take you to the page. I point this out because I also want you to notice our talking volume schedule front and center on the Mid-Morning book page. Wally Lamb is going to be here on November 20th at the Fitzgerald Theater. He's the author of She's Come Undone, I Know This Much Is True, big bestsellers, Oprah book picks, and his new fiction novel. I mean, this is his first fiction in 10 years, is called The Hour I First Believed. Tickets are on sale right now at the Fitzgerald Theater Thursday, November 20th. And if you happen to be a new member, a charter member of the Carrie Miller Book Club, your book, Wally Lamb's new novel, is on its way to you right now. That's part of one of the perks of being a member of my club. Details about how to join on the Mid-Morning book page. Back to our conversation this hour with our guest. Randy Johnson is with us. He's Vice President of Labor, Immigration, and Employee Benefits at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And Bill Samuel is with us, Legislative Director for the AFL-CIO. Both of them with us from Washington, where we are taking a look at some of the top priorities on labor's agenda as they anticipate a new administration with Barack Obama and larger Democratic majorities on Capitol Hill. Gentlemen, before we go back to the phones, I do want to ask you about, it appears that there is agreement between your organizations about the idea for a stimulus package. Randy, is that right?
Yeah, it's a little out of my
for
area.
Another.
I'm not sure we agree on all of the, you know, exactly what it would be, but yes, we certainly agree that there should be a stimulus package.
And Bill Samuel, what do organizations like yours believe should be in it if, as Nancy Pelosi is saying, she wants to pass another one very soon?
Well, I think the government needs to step in boldly now. We've got an economy in crisis. Consumers aren't spending money they frankly don't have. I reported on the news earlier about Best Buy.
Right.
Circuit City is in bankruptcy. The automakers are close to bankruptcy. We've got to jumpstart the economy in a major way. We've got to put people back to work, and that's essentially what a stimulus would do. It would provide jobs, unemployment insurance benefits, which will put money in people's pockets who can't find a job. That will get cycled through the economy. It will help state and local governments, we hope, meet some of its their obligations. Maybe a temporary increase in the food stamp allotment. Again, okay. Food prices are going up. These are the elements of a stimulus that seem widely acceptable.
Okay. So again, we are, just to be clear for our listeners here, we are not talking about the kind of stimulus that passed last time, where they're specifically sending out checks to Americans or they're putting money into the financial industry. This is more about infrastructure, and that's where you say creating jobs there.
Exactly.
Okay. Let me go back to the phones here to Russell in Plainview. Hi, Russell.
Hi. I kind of have, I guess, on the issue of what we should see from the new administration, I'd like to see a sustainable approach to rebuilding the middle class. And I disagree with Mr. Johnson that what we don't need is sweeping change. I think we do need sweeping change in our country right now. And I think back to when I was growing up in Northeast Iowa in a town of 150 people. The adults who worked in that town worked at the packing house, the meat packing house, worked on the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
They worked at an organized toy company at John Deere and at Flexsteel Furniture, most of those in Dubuque, Iowa. Those jobs are almost all gone now, incredibly less than that. And what all of those jobs had in common was that they had defined benefit pension plans. They had health care that was affordable. And, you know, they had incomes that were raising each year through negotiations. All of those companies were profitable. They made money each year. And I think the other thing that's missing is that the people in that town, the jobs they have now, they don't have unions. And part of that is because of the shifting economy and the inability of workers to have a fair shot at organizing.
Randy Johnson, you want to react to that?
Well, apparently they weren't profitable because they closed down. And I don't know exactly the situations of those companies, but as we can look at, unfortunately, Detroit, sometimes the effect of unionization is it drives up wages higher than that company can sustain in a competitive environment, much of which includes a company's option to move to down south.
Are you saying that you think the automakers are in trouble because the unions were given too generous of packages and wages, or what?
Well, that's certainly part of the problem. Yeah, their entitlement costs for pensions and health care retirees is more than the production costs for cars.
Can we also say that they weren't innovative enough, Randy Johnson, and they didn't get ahead of the curve on this interest in smaller cars and more fuel-efficient cars? Is that part of it, too?
Well, there's lots of problems with Detroit and many of my members. But clearly the entitlement packages that the big three have had to sustain has been a severe problem for them, for their ability to be profitable and to compete against the other car manufacturers.
Bill Samuel, what about that?
Sarah, I think you were trying to make the exact right point here. You can't lay the problems of Detroit at the feet of the auto workers. Those decisions are made in the executive suites. They design the cars, they market them, they decide what kind of fuel efficiency, fuel economy to put into those cars. They made terrible mistakes. I think everybody understands that. And frankly, the Japanese and transplants and Korean transplants that are in the U.S. are paying the same wages, providing health insurance.
Now, but they aren't giving the kind of...
They have lower legacy costs.
Yeah, they aren't giving the kind of health care benefits. That
their legacy costs are much less.
They have legacy costs are less because they don't have a workforce that's retiring, like the U.S. companies. But I don't think Americans want to see us race to the bottom here and mimic China or the Asian companies and pay less and provide fewer benefits and less security. I think your previous caller made that point. Americans want to see our companies provide good jobs, and they can afford to do it.
Online here.
Well, they also want a job, Bill, and that's the problem, which is a lot of these jobs have been eliminated. And you're right; it's not a race to the bottom, but it is a compromise on reasonable wages and benefits in a competitive environment. And the unions were hardly neutered at the bargaining table in Detroit. It wasn't the CEO's decisions. They bargained hard at the bargaining table, and it was a mutual decision. That's why the unions were that strong.
Well, collective bargaining is the only system I know of where you can balance the needs of workers and employers.
Well,
employers won't do it on their own.
Detroit belong are they're both at management and unions table. I didn't mean to say just at the unions. It was a mutual problem decision.
Gentlemen, from Jason listening in Holiday, Florida, says how negatively are unions affected by the perception that unions fuel on-the-job laziness and lack of productivity versus the productivity of non-union workers? Is that a perception, Bill Samuel, that the unions might have to address?
It may be a perception that unions have to address. I don't know that it's accurate. I think there have been a lot of studies that morale and training are better. Productivity is better at unionized firms. Turnover is lower. Unionized firms tend to have good programs with their employers to keep advancing the skills of their workers. That perception is out there. I think it's fueled by those who don't like unions for the most part. There may be examples of it in real life, but I'm not sure that it's something that needs to be solved.
Randy Johnson, would your organization be opposing a move to raise the minimum wage? Again, there's talk about this from House and Senate leaders.
Well, it was just raised, Bill, maybe 2
yes.
years ago.
Yeah.
And
goes up to $7.25 this summer.
Right. And before that, I was actually working in the House of Representatives when it was raised under the Republicans. So in this environment, I'm sure we would oppose a raise in the minimum wage. And frankly, I do not see Senator Obama pursuing a raise in this environment either. So yes, we would. It'd be the worst time to impose a new burden on small businesses, which then, you know, people think about it. Well, what's the big deal? It's 25 cents an hour or whatever it might be. Well, it's 25 cents an hour times ever how many workers you may have, times overtime. And small businesses, you know, well, they got to pay a payroll too, and they just can't pass it on or print money. So you got to look at it in the whole overall context, not just in sort of a what would this be with one individual worker. Look at it in the overall context of an entire business.
Bill, is this a priority, or is this something that your organization would wait to see what happens with the economy before you push it?
Well, I think the current minimum wage goes up another step before we're done.
Yes.
We would push for a new increase, though, because very quickly it'll be once again at historic lows in terms of buying power. It used to be that the minimum wage represented about half the average hourly wage. It's much less than that. Workers working full-time, 40 hours a week, aren't even at the poverty level, in most cases, earning the minimum wage. So, listen, the Chamber of Commerce always opposes the minimum wage increase, so we can expect that. Senator Obama, during his campaign, spoke out in favor of having a minimum wage that rises with inflation, index it to some inflation index, and we think that's the way to go. We shouldn't have to refight this every 2 or 3 years.
Let me take a call here from Nicholas in Royalton. Hi, Nicholas, and thanks for hanging on. What did you want to add to this?
Well, I just think that, you know, maybe part of the problem that the unions are having is that they're so politicized these days. I mean, I'm a liberal, and, you know, more power to helping out liberals, but you know, in one of my classes, I saw a Walmart video that, you know, when they were railing against the unions, and, you know, one of the points they made, which is pretty hard to argue against, is, you know, they're giving money to people that I don't even vote for, which, you know, that's not my view, but, you know, there are a lot of blue-collar Republicans out there, and, you know, you guys might have made your time spreading your message if you weren't so tied to one party. And I think at this time, you can look at the new administration in two ways. You can look at the big short-term gains you can make with the administration, but at the same time, you know, the Republicans are in a bad place, and they're going to be looking for friends, and I think you could take advantage of that for a more long-term gain.
Bill Samuel, that's an interesting point. What of that?
Well, we do work across the aisle. We rarely pass legislation in my 25 years in Washington working with one party. We're not tied to the Democratic Party necessarily. More Democrats than Republicans support the kind of agenda we're looking to see enacted, but we do support Republicans. We always have. And Republicans, by the way, support our agenda in lesser numbers than Democrats, but there are some. So I agree with the caller that we need to work both sides of the aisle.
Bill, is there a sense of, again, the unions having spent $450 million through political action committees and other ways to turn out the vote for Barack Obama and to help bring in this greater Democratic majority? So is there a sense of we've been in a long dry spell here, we've waited for a long time, move quickly, you owe us?
You know, I hate to say it, but business always outspends labor in terms of political dollars. So although it sounds like a lot of money, most of it is aimed at our own, you know, membership. It's education, mobilization, registering people, getting them out to vote. So are we owed this? No, that's not the way we look at it. We think we have an agenda which matches up pretty well with Senator Obama's and Senator Biden's, and we're happy that they got elected. We hope to work with them to implement as much of it as possible.
Randy Johnson, is this going to be a tough 4 years for people who do what you do?
Well, my labor policy committee met yesterday, and in fact, Bill spoke to them, and I can tell you it was the biggest turnout I've had for quite some time. And we are looking at the labor agenda here, which Senator Obama may push.
You're not convinced?
Well, I think he's got a lot of people to sort of respond to in terms of their political support. And he's going to have to deal with the economy first, I think, above all other things. The card check legislation is going to be a huge battle. Perhaps the senator is not going to want that early on in his presidency. But we are very worried, and we haven't even talked about the 40 other pieces of labor legislation.
I know.
Right behind the Employee Free Choice Act. So we're concerned, but we've survived before, and we will survive again. We've survived the joint Senate-House Democrat majorities under Jimmy Carter and for a period under Clinton. And my experience is I worked on the Hill for 10 years before this, and no matter which party is in the majority, it's the majority party that usually breaks up into their own little camps and starts quarreling with each other, whether it's Republican or Democrat.
and you're hoping
that'll
for
happen
that,
in this
huh?
case. And Bill's probably worried about that happening.
Hey, Bill, are you worried about that happening? Maybe I should ask you that.
it's obviously something to guard against. It does happen. Randy's exactly right. Parties get in power, and they sometimes fracture. We hope that doesn't happen. The last 2 years when the Democrats were in majorities in the House and Senate, they actually showed a rare degree of unity, and we hope working with the new president that will continue. So.
We have an online comment here from Lori in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. She says, years ago, the Saturn Company came into being with labor and management committees, which were successful. Why not try this again with the auto industry?
That's a great point. It was a great experiment. I think the Saturn may not have survived. I don't think it had anything to do with the Joint Labor Management Cooperation. I don't think Randy would argue that that's why Saturn is in trouble with the rest of the auto industry. So I agree. We should be trying that throughout the economy.
Bill, have I hit the key priorities on the agenda here? We've talked about the minimum wage. We've talked about the card check. I mentioned the equal pay and removing time limits to sue if you feel like you've been discriminated against. Are there other?
Well, there is actually one major one you didn't mention, and that's paid sick leave. You know, we're one of the few Western democracies that doesn't have any federal guarantee that if workers get sick, they can get time off. About 40% of workers in this country don't have any sick leave policy at work. That's really, you know, sort of a 19th century situation. A system mm-hmm. where workers have to decide to forego pay or come to work sick. You know, we passed the Family Medical Leave Act back in 1993 over the objection of the Chamber of Commerce. It's turned out to be a very successful law. That provides unpaid leave. That's a good start. But again, many people can't take advantage of it. We think we ought to be looking at some minimum guarantee of sick leave, 5 or 6 days a year. Every company should provide that.
So this would be a mandate for all companies, or would you cut this off at a certain size of a company?
There are different proposals. I think probably very small companies would be exempt from this. It depends which bill you're looking at, and we'd obviously be willing to talk about that. But there ought to, for most companies, most employers ought to provide
security. Randy, the chamber going to oppose that strongly?
Well, the 40% figure is misleading. That's 40% of formal sick leave policies. In fact, and I think your listeners would agree that the vast majority of employers work out some sort of minimal sick leave with their employees, even though it's not a formal policy. We don't have sick leave here at the chamber. What we have is time off, and it's a certain amount, whether it's sick or vacation time. You've got a bank, and you use it. That would not qualify for 7 days of paid leave under these surveys. But, you know, that being the case, and Bill's talking about the Kennedy bill, you know, it sounds like a simple concept, but if you print it off, it's about 40 pages long. And how they calculate the leave and how it's enforced with punitive and compensatory damages and jury trials. These bills are always a lot more complicated than they sound in the soundbite.
Is that a yes that you'll oppose it or what?
I would suspect that in the end we would oppose it because my experience on these issues is it might be 7 days this time around, and once it's on the books, the 2 years from now, it's going to be 14, then it'll be 21, then it'll be 33. And you never go back.
It'll be 33 days of sick leave? You're kidding.
Well, whatever, you know, 7, 7, 7. Every year, it'll just be a small little one-sentence amendment in the bill. But, for example, it covers, most people think, you know, well, does it cover full-time employees? Well, this defines a full-time employee as one who works 30 hours a week. And then it's prorated for part-time employees below that. It covers, as I recall, Bill, very small employers, 15 or less, might be 25. And so it's not just the leave, it's the enforcement that goes with it, also the intricacies. For example, who controls the leave? Does the can the employee just take it off with very little notice to the employer? Or who decides whether or not the employee?
Well, we're talking about
those kinds of things.
I'm not sure how much notice is possible. Listen, we wouldn't need all this enforcement written into these laws if employers behaved and observed them. But if you look at the wage and hour laws, the occupational safety and health laws, there are widespread violations, particularly in low-wage industries. Lots of studies and surveys have been done. So to complain about having enforcement measures put in these bills, I mean, just ignores the fact that it's necessary to keep employers from violating the law.
I don't think you really need jury trials, unlimited punitive and compensatory damages. But, you know, if you want to look at what employers are doing for Americans, it's 170 Americans are covered under the employer-based health care system. It's like 180 under the pension system. system isn't perfect, but private sector employers provide their employees trillions of dollars in benefits. So you're right. It's a big country, and the system isn't perfect. But do we need a new mandate from Capitol Hill that covers every single employer in this country? I guess we would say no, but we're willing to have that debate.
Bill, I just have one quick question. I have just a couple minutes left here. Do you feel that because Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, were both talking about this equal pay issue on the campaign trail, do you think what they were talking about, which is basically just removing these time limits to sue if you think you've been discriminated, is enough? I mean, couldn't we have more forward-looking legislation on that or not?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think what they're referring to is the recent Supreme Court case in the Lilly
Ledbetter
case,
yeah.
Right, which needs to be overturned by Congress because, workers don't know that they're being paid down a discriminatory
basis. But is that enough? I guess I'm asking you.
Well, there are other pieces of legislation that would require employers just to have a little more proof that they're not discriminating, to show a little more of their own employment practices before they can claim that there's no discrimination at the workplace. It would give the Equal Opportunity Commission more power involving wages, encourage the Department of Labor to investigate these cases. So there are things that can be done in addition to just overturning the Lilly Ledbetter case.
Well, I have to say, I think we're going to have to revisit these issues once we see what happens with the new administration on Capitol Hill, and I hope you'll both come back to do that. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Bill Samuel, Legislative Director for the AFL-CIO, with us this morning from Washington. Randy Johnson, Vice President of Labor, Immigration, and Employee Benefits at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he was also with us this morning from Washington. At 10, Stephen Keselowski is with us in the studio, out with a beautiful new book of photographs and text called The Last Polar Bear. There are essays in the book and interspersed with these amazing series of photographs that Stephen Keselowski has taken on his journeys up into the Alaskan Arctic. These are photographs of polar bears like you've never seen them before. We have a slideshow on the mid-morning page. I hope you'll check that out and get a sense of what we're talking about. And this ought to be an interesting conversation. Stephen Keselowski in the studio with us at 10 o'clock. One of the books that is featured on the mid-morning book page, how to find it. I'm still getting emails from listeners saying, I can't find your book page. Mid-morning page, look on the right-hand side. You'll see a link that says, What Carrie's Reading? Click it. It'll take you directly to the mid-morning book page. You're going to see what we have coming up in the immediate days today and books that are coming up early next week. But you can also look ahead and see what I'm reading through the end of November and into early December, and we'll be updating it very soon because now we're starting to book books and authors into January and February. So we'll update the page soon, and I hope you'll check it out. Coming up tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, we're going to talk about the homeowner plans that are floating around Congress. Treasury Secretary Paulson right now giving a briefing about his view of what's going on with the economy and the bailout. Part of what's happening, part of the discussion is what to do about so many American homeowners who face foreclosure. We'll talk about all of that tomorrow morning at 9. This is Mid-Morning.
Today's programming is supported by the College of St. Scholastica, offering independent research showing that graduates of St. Scholastica report a high satisfaction with their education and a strong sense of purpose. St. Scholastica. Direction for life.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.